If you're navigating through Hollywood, let Todd Garner be your guide.
Everybody should get a Todd Garner.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Recent guests include Kevin James.
You were born in Long Island.
And is it really an island?
It's three sides, I think.
Isn't that a peninsula?
Kind of is, like Florida.
I don't even know if it's an island.
Ed Helms.
You also love acapella.
I want to be clear. I am acapella neutral.
And Avengers director Joe Russo.
There's a direct connection between Arrested and Community and what we did in Infinity War.
Don't miss The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner on Podcast One.
Hey everybody, what's going on? Rob Sisterner here with some special coverage here on Rob Has a Podcast. I'm here at Podcast One today to interview one of my colleagues here over at Podcast One. He is the host of The Producer's Guide. His name is Todd Garner, and very excited to make your acquaintance, Todd.
Hi. Me too, man. I'm a fan. I mean, I've been a fan of the show forever, and one of the first things I saw about you when I was, you know, getting ready to do this was just Jeff Probst's affection for you, calling you by far the best player that's not won.
Yes. I think he has walked that back a little bit since then. That was a long time ago that he said that, but still, I appreciate it. He said it, and we can't delete the footage.
That's so, right. No, he said it to me literally an hour ago.
Yeah. And so, Todd, just to give the listeners some background on you, So you are a veteran Hollywood producer. Could you give the audience some of your credits?
Yeah. I mean, I've been in this business for about 28 years. I was a studio executive, worked my way up at Disney for 10 years, and then a studio called Revolution Studios for 3 years. And then I started becoming an independent producer. And so some of my movies that I've worked on as an executive are Con Air. I worked on Pearl Harbor. I worked on The Waterboy with Adam Sandler. Mm-hmm. I've worked on Black Hawk Down, Punch Drunk Love, Coyote Ugly, pretty much every movie that Jerry Bruckheimer or Sandler did in the 10 years I was there. Those were my accounts. And then as a producer, I've produced, you know, Paul Blart Mall Cop. I produced Tag. I produced Isn't Romantic, which just came out with Rebel Wilson. And I've done a few horror movies in between, but mostly in the comedy and action genres.
And you've recently gotten into the podcasting.
Yeah.
That your podcast talks about some of the challenges of producing in Hollywood.
Yes. In a weird way, it's very much like being on Survivor. It's like just everybody wants to vote you out and everybody is trying to win the $1 million.
And you love Survivor.
I do. I've been friends with Jeff for a long time. And I was a fan of the show before I met Jeff. Jeff and I met through mutual friends, these writer friends that I know. And I just geek out over the show and the way it's made. And so he and I became really good friends. And he's just one of the best guys ever.
Yeah. And you interviewed Jeff on The Producer's Guide. That it sounded like that you guys spoke, it seemed like it was right before David versus Goliath dropped.
Yes. And I wanted him on the podcast because I bug him all the time about stuff probably nobody else ever asks him. Like, why do you use helicopters? Like, that seems so wasteful, you know? And he said, you know,
as opposed to like a drone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it didn't seem to make any sense. And they're now finally using
drones. They do more stuff.
Like, and he would never use GoPros. I'm like, you got these poor guys, these huge underwater cameras underwater. Why don't you use GoPros? And he said, he went to the network and said, look, there's only certain shots I can get with these smaller cameras. And they let him do it. So I've been geeking out over... And also, just having made so many movies in my life and being out on location and taking so many people, just crew and cast out to, you know, the Dominican Republic or Hawaii, what a pain in the ass it is to feed and house those people. And then you've got these Survivor contestants that are literally out there on their own. How the hell do you do it? You're out there for 90 days because you're filming, you know, two shows back to back. How does it work? How do you feed those people? What is the Ponderosa? How does it work? So I've just been a huge nerd about the actual nuts and bolts of how to make the show. And also, just like you, like you being that super fan and the strategy that goes into it and the gamesmanship that goes into it. And now, my wife hosted a show called the World Poker Tour back in the day. And you watch poker players play – the difference between a poker player who has grown up playing poker in like tournaments and the online players who just don't give a crap if you bluff because it's all their math is how I think this game of Survivor is evolving. Is like the super fans now, it's almost like a player that plays poker online. It's just they know all the moves that have ever been made, and they can go, oh, that's going to be this. I need to do this. I need to. It's amazing to watch this game evolve over the years.
Well, I'm really eager to get your take on everything that's going on currently and sort of big picture, because you know, in the podcasting world, that's to some degree, you know, we are a little bit in an echo chamber in terms of the Survivor podcast world. So there's a lot of things that just are said and repeated and repeated back. So I am interested always to get like a little bit of an outsider perspective on things. So this season that's currently on right now, what are your thoughts on this season? Are you enjoying it?
Yeah.
And if so, why?
Yeah, well, I think all of it, I think the biggest challenge for the show, and it now firmly rests on Jeff's shoulders, is to come up, and we talked about it on my episode, is to come up with the storyline, because it's not just, it's not like the NFL. It's not like, you know, all right, everybody jump in the water and do some, he specifically is so thoughtful about the story.
Right.
And making sure that the story is consistent through the challenges, the way the camps are set up, the way the contestants are cast, that all their stories fall in line, like David, you know, versus Goliath, or you know, redemption or extinction.
Yeah.
And so to watch the stories play out has been fascinating. And what was very interesting about this season so far was at first, before extinction was,
you can call it the edge.
The edge was revealed.
Yeah.
No, it was like people thought they were being voted out.
Right.
Once it was revealed, the game's play changed. Like you saw David when he was voted out. He was like, I'm coming right back.
Yeah.
Like it was fascinating again to watch. And that's such a testament to Jeff and the writers, is to be able to shift that game knowing that, oh, there's a way back now. It's not just a thing that's over there that's going to be, you know. And so I love the way the game has evolved through the 38 seasons, but also how the stories have evolved, and how like your story and all these different stories of people, or David's story, like everybody's so behind him,
right?
That the people's personal stories have managed to come out in inside of these stories, which is fascinating.
Yeah, a lot of interesting stuff that you said there. And one of the interesting observations that you made when you spoke with Jeff was talking about how, you know, that one of the challenges or opportunities for the show that they remain in Fiji season after season, where it's not like a cheat where, hey, oh, we're in Africa. Okay,
right.
So let's just do all the Africa stuff. We're in this part of the world. Let's just do all this stuff. So the show is sort of forced to, you know, it's a little bit like a, you know, black box theater where, okay, the location is the same, but what's the different story?
Exactly. Exactly.
That we're going to tell this time around. But that's interesting what you say about, you know, that, and I don't know if we've made this observation, but since the reveal of the Edge of Extinction, I think that has really freed up a lot of the players in the game, where, you know, that's sort of where people are taking now really big swings. And maybe it is because of the chance, like, okay, well, let me take this shot. And if it doesn't work, I still have another shot to get back into the game, because this post-merge game has really gotten, you know, very wild in terms of that. It's almost a challenge to follow what's going on, because the players are, this is, I think, in my mind, the most fluid that it's ever been, where, okay, there's this group of people, okay, and they all voted out this person this time around, and then you expect, okay, well, then they'll vote out the rest of the people that didn't vote with them last time, and then it completely shifts from vote to vote, where, you know, it could be any random group of this five or six people, where it's very hard to even say, who are two people that are currently in the game right now that are working together?
Yep. Well, you said it really, really well this last week on your show, but that it's, there are no two people. And, and again, everybody's kind of mystified that no one's playing the game the way the game was played. I think it's partly because the Edge is like out there and they know they can potentially come back. So I think that's one piece of it. The second piece of it is, again, you players have dissected this show down to the molecules, and you all know that there's basically three things, right? You're playing to eliminate people, you're playing to make your game last as long as it can, but there's a third piece, which is probably the most important, which is, you know, eventually you're going to be judged on your game. And it used to be, back in the day, I was fascinated because the person that went the furthest and never won was the and the passenger, you talked about your metaphors, was always the passenger to the strongest player. So it was the guy or woman who hung behind like a pilot fish on the on the strongest player, and they would get to the final two, and then they wouldn't win because they wouldn't. And it went on like that for a long time. Like, you could have just the strongest player who was a beast at challenges and played the crazy social game, had their little sidekick that would always vote with them, and they could always make it to the end and never win. That then, when super fans began to dissect that, they're like, oh, okay, well, I can't do that. So at some point, I'm going to have to make a big move, break from that player, usually kill that player, and then plead my case to the jury. What's happening now, which is fascinating, is like with the edge being out there, is that the players, in my opinion, are taking these big swings to make their case to the jury, and there are no alliances because like Wardog is going, well, now it's time for me to make a big move against Wentworth, because that'll be strong for my game. Not thinking, what does that do to my alliance? Because all he's going to do is try to come back to camp and rebuild an alliance for this week. And you made a point of like, we'll always have tonight on your podcast, where you said, we'll always have tonight. What's going to happen next week? I don't think anybody's thinking that long term. I think it's like, since nobody has alliances, screw it. I'll just go to the beach and I'll figure out a case to make for, okay, now we're down to eight. I'm going to put these five together. We'll get rid, and then it'll flip again.
Yeah.
Because I think that too many times on seasons when you've seen pleading to the jury, you get boned because everybody says, well, you were just in the alliance with Joe.
Right.
And he took you all the way to the final four and then you killed him. That's not that big a deal.
Well, I also think that it's a factor of, you know, in the beginning of the show, you used to have a final two and you could be a little bit more subtle about your game. And then as long as people liked you generally more than the other person, then you were able to win the season that way. But now it's expanded to a final three. And really, it's kind of a final four now with the evolution of the fire making twist. So you can play, you know, that, you know, a quiet game and get to the end, but it's not going to be enough because that you have potentially, you know, two or three other people that you're going to be vying against to eventually be the person that people want to award the money to at the end of the season.
Right. Can I ask you a couple questions?
Go for it.
That I've always been on my mind, that I've always wanted to ask players. And
fire
and
away,
I can't ask Probst because he's never played. When you are playing the game, or let's say you're in the jury, do you vote for someone you like, or do you? This is what always occurs to me. Do you vote for someone you like, someone you think needs $1 million, or someone you really thought played the best game? Like, for example, if you're playing basketball and some guy just repeatedly stuffs you, do you give him $1 million because he just beat the crap out of you? Or do you go like, screw him, I'm going to give it to them to stick it to them? Because it seems like the votes are pretty unanimous.
Yeah. I believe that the jury, 99% of the time, votes for the person they like the best. And all those other reasons are just the justification for that.
Okay.
I don't know if there's ever been a person who has been on a jury who has one person they like, the other person they don't like, the other person that they don't like played the incredible game, and they end up saying like, I love this person more, but I got to give the vote to the other person.
Right.
Every other time that they come up with these reasons, it's all just the rationale behind why the person I like played the better game and the person that I like did this. And sometimes they like both people,
right,
and then it'll come down to that they'll say, okay, well, this person did more. I like both of them, but no one will ever vote for a person that they did not care for, even if they played a really good game.
And so someone mentioned the fact that when Wentworth went back and said, I have an idol. Oh, by the way, Lauren also has an idol. That someone said, well, they thought that she was kind of feeling like it was the Ponderosa.
Yeah.
How much of that plays into it in the jury when you're sitting at the Ponderosa what's happening there? Are you guys talking about like, oh, that guy did this? And are you figuring out like, oh, piecing things together? Oh shit, that's how I got blindsided.
I think it really comes down to the person why the Edge of Extinction is interesting in terms of that being the jury. Cause I think there's some people that they come out of the game and they're like, all right, well, you know, I'm done. I'm checked out now.
Come on, go get a burger.
You can get a burger, you get a beer, I'll be at the beach.
Right.
And so they sort of like turn off the game. And then there's other people that they still feel like they're in it. They want to know everything. And then they also want to impact the jury because I still have like my being here still has meaning if I can, you know, I'm still playing the game because that person that screwed me over, that person that put me here on the jury in the Ponderosa, I'm going to get back at them because I'm going to poison the well now against them. And I'm going to sort of like, you know, really, oh, you didn't hear what they said about, oh, they hated you. You wouldn't believe. So it really comes down to the type of people and then the way that people go out of the game. And, you know, that's where we get into the idea of sort of like a bitter jury. But I think that what's really fascinating down the stretch here with the Edge of Extinction is going to be how does a group of people that are basically still playing the game and then who will then be asked to put on their jury hats at the end of this,
right?
Because they are still so, you know, feral and raw from being out there on the Edge of Extinction. How will they handle the task? I would be very surprised if it's one of these completely unanimous decisions at the end of this season.
Right. I have a couple more. Sorry.
Go for it.
And then you and Boston Rob are two of my favorite players. Boston
yes.
Rob, can I? There is not a moment. I told Jeff this. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't think about the moment where Boston Rob was laying on the ground and he was dehydrated and he was out of the game.
I heard you talked about this with Jeff.
Oh, I'm obsessed with it. And he finally just went, and he came back to life. He goes, I just can't be that. I have to be myself. I just have to be my true character. I think about it all the time.
This game is getting the best of me, Jeff.
But so you two guys.
Yes.
And by the way, the Bionic Man who is, I think God put his saber on him and said, you are going to be the best Survivor player of all time, which is Joe in terms of just.
Well, I know that's
the problem. How can you or Boston Rob, again, or Joe ever win this game now?
Rob has won the game.
No, I know, but now. Because I think the super fan thing and people are so – I was shocked that Boston Rob won that year, by the way. But how now, knowing that – and again, this has sort of proven it, where instantly the newbies are like, I'm not going to let the veterans have this story.
Right. Well, Rob might have been the one that broke this.
Yeah.
That he came in. But what Rob did was very smart. He came back in the season with Rob and with Russell. And so they both had these opportunities to sort of be, you know, to mold this group of people. And now it just so happens that the group of people that were with Rob there were a lot of followers there. And the couple of people that were not followers, Rob was able to smartly get rid of. Whereas, Russell was with a group that had, some more independent thinkers, but he also sort of isolated himself from the group, and he got himself to a point where they hated his guts so much that they threw a challenge to get rid of him.
Right.
So Rob came in and really, coached up that group of people, and I was surprised that we didn't see the returning players do this more in this season. And I wonder if it's a difference between there were two of them versus if there was one of them. If it was just Joe with the group of comma people, could he have taken them and sort of become their cheerleader? And that was really what Rob was able to do. I think the world of Boston Rob as a player, because I think that he is one of the few people that's like a true triple threat, where he's incredibly brilliant when it comes to the strategy. The guy plays poker. He knows all the odds and everything like that. He also is incredibly social, where that he can be, you know, the big brother to one person and, the captain of the football team to somebody else. And so he can really cater the dynamic of the relationship to the person that he's playing with. And then also, you know, he is, incredibly strong in the challenges, especially, in his prime, could, toe-to-toe with anybody in the challenges. So an incredible threat. But he was able to, get those people really invested in what he was trying to build. And he was sort of like the cheerleader and basically said, hey, follow me. I know what to do. And if we all stick together, we can ultimately, you know, take out the other side. And he really almost like built in like a, you know, cult mentality where when they got to the merge in that season, he didn't want any of his people talking to the other people. He made his people sleep in a different shelter than the other people.
Right.
And so there was none of this like commingling. So there were people that were trying to say, hey, come, you know, come flip against Rob. Let's vote out Rob. He made everybody have a buddy. I mean, it was like that. He really had it was a dictatorship. And I mean this in, you know, the most flattering of ways, where he said, hey, everybody, you need to have a buddy. And then if your buddy is talking to the other tribe, you come back and tell me. So it was like he set up like, so many fail safes of, you know, people are going to get greedy. People are going to consider flipping to the other side.
Right.
And he built in a bunch of systems where everybody had to have a buddy. There was, you know, if somebody was that he incentivized people snitching on the other people so that they would come back and tell him. And he said it in his first season, but he said that
I would rather be feared than loved. That's straight out of The Godfather.
All your impressions are spot on, by the way.
Thank you. But it took him, you know, four tries to ultimately get it worked out. And, you know, a lot of people say that he could have won or should have won the season that he went to the end with Amber. But that's more of the classic scenario that you're talking about where, you know, you have somebody who is sort of like calling the shots and the other person who's the follower. But in that case, that he made so many people upset with him that they ultimately gave the money to the person who was the follower, but the joke was on them because then he proposed to her and they're married and they have four kids.
That's
now.
That's amazing. And then to add to that, what do you like for 39 days on the beach?
Yeah.
You know, there's cameras everywhere. People are being pulled away for their stand-ups. Is there a rhythm to it? Is it chaos? Are you constantly thinking about odds and are you constantly playing poker? How did it work for you in terms of just your gameplay? It just seems so – I don't know. People just seem to slip right into it and they forget. So Jeff said the cameras – but like it's so funny. Like David finds the idol – I mean, the advantage, and then he seems to be sitting right where he finds the advantage. Do the producers go, hey, everybody stay away, we're just doing a stand-up here so that he can relax and actually give you a good piece of what's happening?
In that case, David, so that was on the edge of extinction, so I have no idea what's going on. I can't even begin to contemplate how that worked. Now, but, you know, for me, I played so long ago that the game was, a different animal then. And I like to think that the way I was playing very early on, I think was probably similar to the way that people are playing.
I would agree.
Playing the game now.
Did you study the game on? Did you watch?
Well, I was
tapes
a super fan. Yeah.
So did you rewind and figure out your strategy?
I don't know if I rewound, but I just I played with a lot of people that were not super familiar with the show. I think that I was one of the first people that was cast onto the show that was sort of like had this meta knowledge of being one of the people that had studied the show coming in. And, you know, everybody that I was out there with had seen the show, but very few people that I was out there with really, you know, knew the show, could tell you all the players and what happened and what went wrong and sort of were thinking about, you know, the numbers in that way. It was, you know, very much at a point where the game was beginning to go through, the, you know, one of its first evolutions where then people were thinking more about, hey, I don't have to stick with the group that I started with. And so that had been a little bit in the ether. And there had been sort of like a big flip in the game in Survivor Marquesas. But I think that I was probably the first person to look at it more from an individual aspect of like, okay, I don't need my five people to, you know, switch, or my three people to switch to a group. Like, I could be the person that I could vote with this group this time. And I could vote with this group. And
sure,
it's not like I went in thinking of that that's how I would play. But that was something that when the circumstances presented themselves, you know, I was able to say like, oh, what if I do this? You know, what if I make this move this round? And what's been fun is that the game has, you know, sort of really evolved to that. So some people would say to its detriment, you know, some of these, people who, don't like, you know, how fast paced the game has gone. But I think that the show would be stale if we, you know, did not get to this point.
Yeah. So tell me about the beach. Tell me, like, in the 39 days, Are you just constantly in your head going, if I did this, I would do that? And then what's happening, because this is, again, just my, I, like you said, an inch wide and a mile deep in terms of my thing. I just love how the show is made. Mm-hmm. So how many cameramen are running around? What's happening? Because Jeff told me the most amazing thing where he said, someone's going fishing. And then the producer's like, okay, we got him. Take him down. Then we're going to hand off to this guy who's got a water camera. And then the drone is flying, which, or a helicopter, flying over. And then we're going to get underwater. We're going to see him capture the fish. And then we're going to bring – walk me through that. Like, what is that like?
I can, you know, I can tell you what it was like for me. Yeah. And I'm sure that it has, you know, also evolved over the years as they've, you know, made, you know, 38 seasons of the show. Whereas when, you know, the game would start, this was at the time we had 8 people in the tribe. And so there would be some days where you'd have, like, 2 different camera crews, and you have a guy with the big camera, and then another guy with the boom, and then another person who was like a sound mixer, and you have basically like two teams of those people, and they'd be sort of following the action, and so they're sort of like you know, getting the overall group. Or if two people wander off, if you wander off by yourself, you know, there's just like not the resources where every single thing that could happen on camera is captured. Now, I'm not sure necessarily like in the days now of like where there's hidden immunity idols, where if then you you know how they're covering all of that and everything that's going on in terms of like, do you need to tell the field producer, hey, I'm gonna sneak off for a little bit. So that I don't know. But then sometimes like one of those cameras is then filming interviews, and in the 3-day episode cycle that you have, there would be the reward challenges on the first day, then like all of the interviews that you would do with the producer would be on the second day, and then the third day is like the immunity challenge, and then ultimately tribal council.
Wow. So you're used to people going off because you figure, oh, they're doing their stand up somewhere. So it's not like you're going,
right,
where the hell's Rob? You know, every moment. Where now, because everybody's looking for idols,
right,
you would have to. Otherwise, it's not that hard to keep track of 8 people.
It wouldn't be that hard. But now, you know, there's more people in the tribes,
right,
and so I don't know if it's, hey, I had to go to the bathroom, like, don't follow me. So there's, a couple of different reasons. But if somebody's gone for too long, you know, that does, like, raise the suspicion.
And now, I mean, just with these super fans, you can just see the gamesmanship constantly working.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ones who don't just eventually get, you know, either get pulled along because they're weak players or just get voted out.
Right. And that's super important. You know, you gotta think about the game. But the other part of it that still hasn't gone away, and the part that is really hard for us to talk about, and it's also, I think, very difficult for the show to show us, where this is something that came last season, where there were people like Mike, who talked about his social game, and Kara, who talked about her social game, that they felt like that, you know, they had good claims to win based on the strength of their social game. But that's something that's very hard for the show to really demonstrate. Like,
right,
if somebody is very, you know, thoughtful and caring and can have, like, you know, sort of like, you know, great, you know, 2-hour conversations with you and your about your family and your pets and everything and your college, well, that's never going to make it to the air. So we don't really know, other than if somebody is telling us, I hate this person's guts or I love this person, it's very hard to tell how the other players actually feel about this. And just to go back to what we were talking about earlier, where the jury is always going to vote for the person that they like the best personally, and then, you know, if they like both people or don't like both people, then we'll get into things about talking about the game. So it is very hard to get a sense of, you know, who actually might beat another person if it came down to, you know, people matched up against each other in the end, because there's so much about the social game that we don't know, because that by the, there's so much crazy strategy,
right,
going on, and idol hunting and the edge of extinction. It's very hard for any of that to ultimately make it into the show.
Yeah, and some of it, so much of it is challenges and puzzles and things like that.
Right, and not that that would be exciting to show either.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you were so smart, because I've heard you say a couple times, one is the word under edit, and the other was you said about the Wentworth thing about her talking about the idols. They probably wouldn't have put it in if it wasn't going to mean something. You're very smart about editing. You're also smart about storytelling. You can see you're lifting the veil of definitely, like, That character's been under-edited. Maybe they're holding the story back.
Right. And I don't like to talk about it too much. I mean, there are people that really study this stuff of like, oh, okay, well, this person had this many confessionals on this day, and this person, so obviously this person can't win because they haven't gotten enough confessionals. And I really do think that takes the fun out of the show.
And also, I'm positive that the producers hear that feedback.
Yes.
And I'm not even talking about that in terms of like trying to mislead the audience. I'm just talking about just in pure storytelling about what's the best way to tell the story. Because the thing that astounds me also is now, especially, let's say you have 8 camera crews or whatever it is, and all this footage to be able to hone this into one story that makes sense, that's not giving away, you know, because also the thing that was interesting in the tribal council, as you said, the thing about blindsides is when you think everything's going perfect, you're probably going to get blindsided. When you guys are on the beach and stuff, were you surprised very often when you were on the show with the votes, or did you have a suspicion even the blindsides?
Yeah, there was only one time that I was really surprised.
and that's when you got voted off.
That was when I got voted off when I came back the second time.
What was the difference? Did it feel different?
Well, it did. It felt like I didn't really know what was going on. Whereas, you know, I've played in 2 different seasons, and I played in the Amazon, and I knew everything that was going to happen every single step of the way. And then I played in the All Star season, where then I was playing with the returning players that came right after I had played the first time, and so people, you know, didn't want to give me, you know, an inch,
right?
And I guess in some ways, you know, it's a similar feeling to what the returning players like Joe might have felt like, where it's like, okay, well, doesn't matter what I do, they're not going to let me. But I was just, you know, not in the loop on what they were going to do, and it did not feel good. And you know, I felt very very uneasy, but I just, you know, tried to convince myself it's gonna be fine,
right?
Like, it's gonna be fine. I didn't, you know, allow myself to get into panic, because I felt like that if I get paranoid also, then it's gonna be the kind of thing where I'm gonna make this a thing out of nothing, where, you know, if I start telling everybody that they're lying to me, I don't know if it's gonna necessarily, like, one, it's not gonna change their mind, and two, it might force the issue. So I said, like, well, let me just, you know, cross my fingers here tonight and hope for the best, because I just didn't have any reason to, other than my previous time out, that it was going to be me, and it didn't feel good going in, and you know, it ultimately was, you know, all the votes came for me.
And how much is the $1 million weighing on your mind the entire time? And then how it's got to be, because to use your Monopoly analogy,
yes,
you did. It's got to be so much worse to get almost to the very tip of the spear.
You know, that for me, and I when I played the first time, I was 24 years old, and I got right there to day 38 and lost, and right before the end. But, you know, it really was never a thought in my mind about the million dollars and what it would mean and how it would change my life. And in a lot of ways, I really do feel this way, that I think that I don't know what my life would have been like had I won Survivor at 24 years old, because I've seen a lot of people who have won the game at very young age, and it's a very hard thing to process, and it can really, you know, screw people up. And I think that because of the way that my life ultimately ended up going, where I didn't win Survivor at 24 years old, I ended up then coming out to Los Angeles, and I started working in production and learning a whole bunch of different skill sets, and I feel like that I'm in a much better place in my life now, today, having to, you know, really have, you know, earned everything and gotten to a place where, you know, I'm really happy with the direction and the trajectory that everything has gone. Would it have been the same? You know, would I have gotten into, a bunch of bad habits of, you know, and partying and stuff like that from having all that money at a young age? I do feel like that as an adult with a family, I do think that sort of blow of getting so close to the end and then thinking about, like, what is this money going to mean for my children in terms of their college and for my wife and for my the people that are in my life as an adult. I think as a young person, I think it's easy to say, you know, easy come, easy go. But I think, you know, as a 40-year-old person, I think
leaving
that would
your family for that long as well,
right? And I've left my family, and I told my wife that I was going out here for, you know, to do this for my family, and then I get right to the end, and then how could you do this to me? And I do think that in terms of these juries, I do do think that sometimes you'll see a, you know, older people on these juries, then it's not just a game for them.
Right.
It's not just that, you know, like, okay, well, you know, que sera, sera. It's, you know, that,
right.
you know, you took this money from my family.
Yeah. And think about how amazing hometowns are. Mm-hmm. Just that, just all the way the whole story is structured and the way that the game is laid out. Cause even this season, you saw that they were bartering the hometowns. Like,
yeah.
it was meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah. That, hey, let's just, like ride it out until the family visit.
Yeah.
And I do feel like that in life and in Survivor, the more that somebody is telling you like, hey, let's just all like wait for this other thing to happen. Like nobody get antsy right now. Just everybody just stake is, you know, the more people are telling you to not think about
yeah.
things, probably means that you're getting a bad deal. And, you know, it was interesting that was able to get sniffed out in this season of a reason why the more they said it, the more people said like, hey, we're going to resist this. And we don't want to just sit around and wait for our families to come.
Yeah. Gosh, man, thank you. Those are just some questions I've had as a fan, and I just always wanted to ask a player about them.
Well, I love how excited you are about the show, and I think it's fascinating to me that you are just so into it, especially I feel like that as somebody who has you know, worked in scripted entertainment, that I feel like that sometimes people like you know, look down at things like reality TV.
Well, first of all, no one calls it reality anymore. It's all called unscripted.
Unscripted.
Yeah.
Yes.
So why I love the show, and also why I love Jeff so much, is it's impossible to keep a show on that long. It mm-hmm. really is, especially a show like this, and or any show. I mean, you look at the greatest, you know, the Seinfelds and MASH and all. He has accomplished something that nobody else has.
Yeah.
And so I'm fascinated from okay, if it was just a reality show in quotes, it probably wouldn't have lasted that long. But because it has these underlying themes and stories, and because there's these twists and turns, and I have not cried at a hometown in 38 seasons. Mm-hmm. Not. I just haven't. And everyone has some other insane surprise. You're like, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that I'm fascinated with the show and such a fan because I learn a lot from the way Jeff puts the show together and the storytelling of the show for my own life, because the show has everything, right? It has you tune in because you have no idea what's going to happen. It has these great underlying characters that you ultimately do care about. You can, like you said, edit and dole out the way a little bit of a manipulation of the way people feel mm-hmm. just through editing, not changing the game. But look, I'm going to highlight this piece of you because that's the part that I'm most attracted to, and I think it's the best for the show and best for the character. Fascinates me. And so I really look at the show as like a really well-crafted, you know, scripted show. If you were trying to script it, you would make these weird, unexpected choices like this one. And you said it again. You said the thing about the double elimination. You wouldn't normally double eliminate two returning players in the same, but you do it, and then you go, "Holy shit, that just happened!" So anything can
yeah.
happen. And so because all those things are built into the DNA of the show, it's really fun for me to dissect it because it. I'm just fascinated with good storytelling, and I think it's beneficial in my whole career.
Yeah. What's really amazing about the show also is that not only does it have the longevity, but also that they do two cycles a year.
Yeah,
where if you have a favorite scripted show, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you get 10 episodes a year, and then 10 episodes a year, and then everybody, like then the actors start to want more money, and then there's 2 years between seasons. And so you have, 26 weeks out of the year, at least, where you're getting new episodes of the show. And what's nice about the cycles is like, hey, all right, I missed that season. You can jump back in. It's not like, oh, okay, I got to go binge
right.
The last 13 episodes so I can catch up on what's going on. Like
right.
if you miss a season of The Walking Dead,
right.
now, you know, oh, wait, there's a 5-year time jump. What? Okay, I'm out. Survivor, you can just like, okay, well, I missed this one and I haven't been watching in 2 years, but this looks good so I can jump back in
right.
for this one.
But even like, unlike Game of Thrones, where you know you are manipulating the audience through your storytelling
mm-hmm.
to have those surprise twists and those surprise deaths and surprise sex scenes as in last week
mm-hmm.
And not even like The Bachelor, right? Where Mike Fleiss is able to completely manipulate.
Who's another
the
one of your friends?
Very love the guy, and I love the way he does the gameplay. Yeah. Like Bachelor in Paradise is my favorite show because I just feel like he's in the bullpen, going like Running Man. Mm-hmm. Like who would she hate to see most? Send him in, you know.
Yeah.
Jeff is completely constrained by the laws of a game show. I even hate to say it, but like the laws of the game show, which is you cannot manipulate the game because there's $1 million at stake that mm-hmm. you, as you said, could change someone's life. The fact that that's a limiting factor also in being able to weave and tell the stories time and time again and make it fresh and interesting season after season is just – it's just – he's the greatest of all time as far as I'm concerned in terms of that kind of storytelling.
Yeah. Is there any of the new players this season that have really popped for you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think Devin's is really interesting. Yes. I just think though his whole vibe, he's a weird combination of so many different characters from seasons past. It's mm-hmm. like he's kind of like not in the best shape, is funny, has a good social game. Like he's been able to put it all together. And I really like Victoria.
Yes.
She's the redhead with the glasses, correct?
Yeah.
She's super interesting to me because she literally feels like she would just kill everybody if she when and if she can. Those two for me have really popped because I feel like it's fascinating to watch people that are you start off by thinking they're middle of the road players. And then you realize they just kind of gather momentum as the show goes on. I personally can't stand players like War Dog. I just feel
yes.
like
what is it about War Dog?
It's just that super arrogant straight line. You know, there's always one. You know, it's like the difference.
You know, Todd, I don't really appreciate.
I love
you. I'm trying to play the game as hard as I can. And I thought that maybe somebody that appreciates the fan, like a super fan like myself, that you would appreciate on a game like mine.
I think the difference between him and Boston Rob is exactly what you were saying, right? So Boston Rob knows when to pull back, puts fail safes in. And I think just that shark-like relentlessness, I honestly think he'll be a better player when he comes back again.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that shark-like relentlessness only gets you so far, where you just are like, you just keep killing and keep swimming. And you feel like, fuck it, as long as I'm swimming in the right direction, I'm swimming fast, no one's going to get me. I think that has proven time and time again that you can only get so far. And then I feel like every time those players come back, they're like, okay, last time I did this, I'm going to switch up my game, and they become much far more interesting players. By the way, David was a more interesting player the second time out.
Well, but can a War Dog turn it off? I think that's
I don't know.
What's interesting about him is I think that he I think he is who he is. And, you know, we saw that when Tony, who, you know, there were so many comparisons.
That's what I. That's who
and,
I.
And
saying.
Then and Tony came back a second time, and I love Tony. I think Tony was incredible to watch. But if I would have talked to Tony before he played a second time, I would have been like, Tony, like take your foot off the gas, like you can't. And what did he do? He came back and he like started. He bolted off into the jungle. And he's like, okay, I'm going to go find the idol now. And then that was it.
I don't know. Do you think? It's such an interesting thing about also this show just reveals human nature. Also, the other thing just about being outside in the elements for 39 days is you can use only so much you can hang on to that bullshit story.
Right.
Eventually, your real shit's going to come out.
That's
right?
What I feel is one of the other things that is beautiful about Survivor, where that you have you can put on a facade in your everyday life,
right.
And it's like okay, and you have like sort of like a trappings of like okay, well I went to this college or. I'm from this family, or I have this position. But Survivor, because of the hunger and the elements and all of these factors, I really do think that it strips like this veneer away. And in some people say like, no, well, I'm not the person I was on Survivor. But to me, I kind of feel like that it does. It reveals a part of who you are that we don't get to see
exactly.
in your everyday life.
Exactly. That is exactly right. Because I know just being on location for me, where I'm not starving and I'm not just being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It definitely brings out your specific tent poles, right? So, for example, being hungry on the beach, you might become really emotional when someone does something nice for you and read into it way more because you're so vulnerable
mm-hmm.
and you're by yourself and someone does something nice and like, I want to be in your alliance. Like, okay. And you normally would be like, no, that's stupid. I'm not trusting that person. They're trying to kill me. That. If you're quick to anger and that's your go-to backstop for your insecurity, that's going to come out because you're hungry and you're vulnerable. And you look at like, you talked about Julie hating Aurora. She hates her. So whatever, yeah. Whatever Aurora's, she's her trigger. Whatever why Aurora's triggering Julie will probably not know, but it can't. She can't help it. It's just that in her being insecure and crying all the time, there's a, you know, she reminds her of somebody or something that's triggering just this inexplicable. Whereas you're sitting on your couch going, you really got to stop that.
That's, yeah.
That you're not playing your game. And that's the thing that's always so other so fascinating to me. And maybe you can talk to this is whenever someone gets completely fixated on another person, it never, ever, ever ends well.
Yeah.
And like you said, if you've watched the show ever, you would go, don't get fixated on someone. It's going to be your demise. And yet it happens every year. So I'm thinking it's got to be because you're hungry and you're freaking out.
Well, I always think back to this, you know, from watching some of the older seasons where, you know, we have in Heroes versus Villains, we talked about Robin Russell when they came back, but really the Robin Russell rivalry started when they were both on the same tribe, on the Villains tribe, and it was just like, hey, you know, this beach isn't big enough for both of us.
Right.
And Rob was gunning for Russell and Russell was gunning for Rob, and you know, at the time it was just like, boy, if they could have just like, hey Russell, put her there, and Rob was out early and Russell goes to the end and loses, so I don't know if it would have been better for Russell, but it certainly would have been better for Rob too. But you know, I think that maybe as sort of like the gambler, okay, I gotta go all in and take my shot at taking this person down. I kept waiting for David and Kelly,
right,
who that they were there, and David was targeting Kelly a lot in the pre-merge, and then Kelly got to the merge and she was going to target David, and there was that moment in that tribal council where everything went haywire in the Rick Devon says like, hey, well, why don't we get a new plan together?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And then Kelly and David, and Kelly was going to vote out David at that tribal council, and then he sits down next and he's like, hi, remember me?
Yeah.
And she's like, hi. And he's like, what was the plan tonight? She's like, hey, we were going to vote you out. And so, and they get on the same page and they vote out Julia. And I said, all right, here we go. This is David and Kelly. And then the next episode starts and Kelly is coming for David.
Yep.
And then he goes out in the first half of the episode and she goes out in the second half of the episode. And they really, I think that even if they never work together, I think just the specter of having the other one in the game, I think served as like a check and a balance where that nobody was going after Kelly or nobody was taking Kelly out because David was still there because he was he was gunning for Kelly. And then we don't want to give David what he wants to go for Kelly and vice versa. And then it was that as soon as he came out of the game, like he was keeping her safe by being in the game and vice versa. So it's a shame that the two of them couldn't have coexisted and gotten on the same page and worked with each other and, you know, had a truce to get to the end where I think that a lot of these people are like, well, I don't want to go to the end with a returning player. Well, for David and Kelly, they didn't have that problem necessarily. Like, they might have been, in terms of like looking for people that would go to the end with them, they might have been some of the only people that would have gone to the end with each other. So it's, I always think that that's a missed opportunity on Survivor. And it's easy for me at home to say, just because somebody has wronged you, why can't you get back on the same page with them? And people say, it's not as easy as it sounds.
No.
But I think it's such an overlooked thing where it's like, oh, well, that person's dead to me. Why not get back with them and see it? Because nobody would expect it.
Right.
And you're cutting off your nose to spite your face.
But it's hard. It's hard for us in human nature either, right? And just someone, someone gives you a shitty look and you just can't let it go. It's just in our human nature. And you magnify that 1,000 times when you're hungry and tired. And also, I've also noticed that a lot of people just like project what they want onto people.
Mm-hmm.
So like, oh, she reminds me of my daughter. Like, okay, she's not your daughter. And so you have these certain maternal feelings that, and the other person might not feel that way at all. So it's this weird mismatch of like, you know, it's always like, I see my mom in her, or I see my friend in her, and they're not that way at all. And sometimes those relationships can really dismantle you.
Right. Well, that's a thing that, you know, we've talked about a lot on the podcast of the plight of, you know, a woman who's older, who's seen as a mother. And now all of a sudden, if she betrays somebody, it's like, well, how could you do this to me? You were like my mom. Okay, but I didn't pick to be remind you of your mom.
Right.
You just thought of me that way. And so that, you know, it's very hard for people to, get over a betrayal from somebody who they remind them of somebody from a specific relationship from the
real world.
And to that end, you're a super fan and you've studied all these. How, if anybody wants to go on the show, how should you act in the first 5 days of camp? Because it feels like people do really stupid things in the first 5 days, like deciding to order everybody around to try to build the shelter or do nothing.
So the way that I would tell anybody to approach the game is that you come in and I think that you want to just get like a baseline positive working relationship with everybody. And then it's almost like it's your first day on a new job and you want all your other coworkers to like you and feel good about you. So that one, if you do lose a tribal council, that you're not a person that, there's no reason for people to come for you and say, okay, well, it's like, we got to pick a name. Who should it be? That guy's getting on my nerves. So let's vote. Right. Let's vote him out. So you want to do it, I think, as much as you can to be able to, you know, lay that foundation. And then once you have that rapport with everybody, now you can start to play the game. Now you have this working relationship. You can't do it the opposite. You can't, you know, that you and I have barely spoke. I can't go to you and like, hey, let's vote out the, you know, Gary. And like, what? Why would I work with you? I don't know. I don't have any positive feelings about you. So I think that the foundation of the social game, I think, needs to be laid out first, more so than, you know, okay, like let's work on the numbers first. And, that was something in the Second Chances season where it was like there were two groups of people that had like a different philosophy. It was the people that like, hey, let's work on the shelter, and the people like, hey, let's work on the game. Let's figure out our plans. And ultimately, for the people that were thinking about their plans, actually, I don't think for either group it really worked out particularly well. Right. But I think that what you want to be doing is, you know, working on sort of like the, you know, this baseline social game and getting your camp squared away and getting, you know, all of the things that sort of get overlooked in the modern game, that I think you need to lay that foundation.
And how do you prepare? How would you prepare now if you were going to go on the show? Would you learn how to make fire like for a year before so that you're prepared for it?
You know what?
Would you gain weight? What would you do now if you were going to go on the show?
I think you want to be in good shape. This might be sacrilege, and if Jeff listens to this, he might they might lose my number. I wouldn't spend a ton of time working on the fire, because you know what, I think I might get there on the first day like, I have no idea how to make the fire. Because I really believe that the game has evolved to the point where every weakness is now a strength.
Right.
Look at Joe. Does Joe have any weaknesses? No.
That's the problem.
He's got to go.
No, that's the problem.
I have no idea how to make the fire. And then now everybody's wheels are turning.
Right.
Oh, I should go to the end with Rob because then he doesn't know how to make a fire.
You may want to go on again. Someone else, not you.
Yeah.
Would you secretly know how to make fire?
I think I would attempt to do it. I wouldn't spend hours and hours and hours, because I think that ultimately it's going to really matter for one person.
Right.
For one person. I should be so lucky to get to day 38 and lose in a fire making challenge. I've got bigger problems if I go back than not knowing how to make the fire.
Right.
So.
Right.
It's not.
But would you camp for? I mean, like, I just can't imagine being outside for 39 days.
That it was a long time ago, but I've done it. I know I'm not going to die. I think I would be fine in terms of the camping. I think I would just do as much as I could to work on myself, as opposed to any particular set of skills of outdoors type skills. I mean, these challenges are, so much of like, stand in one place, balance a plate with a ball in it. I mean, I guess you could practice that.
Work on your core and so you have a better balance.
I guess so. But
it just feels like also some of those things, especially with the feet things, you just have to be.
Is a year of CrossFit going to help you when it comes down to it? So I kind of feel like you could make yourself crazy trying to prepare.
Right.
And ultimately, it's going to come down to, how do you make the people that you interact with for 39 days feel most of the time? And so I don't know how much you can
to quote Maya Angelou, by the way.
Yeah, so I think that what you can do is try to like work on your nervous energy, and then make people feel comfortable and at ease with you. And then I think that I don't know how much it's a very hard thing to prepare for.
It feels like in the evolution of the game to me, and maybe I'm wrong because I've never played, but it felt like water in the beginning was critical.
Like drinking water.
Yeah, because they'd have to make fire to boil the water. Yes. Now there's a well. So that's been taken out of it. Thank God.
Yeah.
Because that was insane.
Yeah, you know what? Honestly, that I don't know. I guess, I do see them, like, they take, like, the ladle and fill up their canteen. So I guess they have, like, a
I think also that dehydration thing on the beach where eight people went down probably solved that
problem. This is a thing where I know there's a purist are like, oh, it's so easy. Who cares how much they eat? Like,
exactly.
Let them, like, feed them a little bit. Let them drink water. Who cares? It's not like, oh, well, this show stinks because they get too much water.
No.
Nobody cares about that.
And also feels like bugs are not as much of an issue. Like, they figured that out. Because remember those first few seasons,
I think that has to do more with the location of where people were in certain seasons. And so, it's not pleasant to look at, but I don't know if they've done anything different other than not being on those, like, in Borneo and some of these places where, you know, these mites are in the sand.
Yeah.
Because
you don't want it also just to be an endurance test of somebody because you don't want people to get hurt.
You don't want people to get hurt. But, you know, do you think that the edge of extinction is that they do want to see how far that they can, you know, test some of these people and how badly people, do want this experience and how willing people are to literally raise the flag when, you know, the going gets tough on the show.
I like it. I like this twist. I think it's been great.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't even played out really, other than just seeing some gamesmanship and, you know, Aubrey running around and practicing that game. It's been interesting finding the rice. So it's going to be a fascinating and throwing these new clues back into the game and these twists, which obviously paid off last week.
Would you want
last week.
Edge of Extinction to be permanent on the show?
No, because I think this is the other problem for Jeff, and he's acknowledged it, and I don't envy him. Is if once somebody knows, like if you go in, you know you're going to play your game out of the gate knowing, well, screw it, I can eventually have a second shot to get back in. I want to make big, bold moves.
Yeah.
Which may be great for the show, but it just does change the gameplay in such a way. So I think if you expect it year in, year out, and you know that it's going to keep coming back up, it would change the game. So I like that he keeps changing, you're there by yourself and then you can come back in. So you missed some gameplay or now there's this whole tribe on that.
So what I would like, if they do it again, I would like to see it end at the merge. That I feel like that this was very fun, that we got to see people like Reem the whole season. Dude, this is late. Read the sign, bro. This ain't no Holiday Inn. You're at podcast one. That was, that was great that we got to see, like, some of these characters that would have been a footnote really, really fleshed out, and we got to see a lot of them. But what I really don't like is the idea of, somebody could potentially, and this almost happened with Ozzy in South Pacific, where Ozzy came back in at I think he came back in at the final five.
Yeah.
I think he won an immunity, and then he
sitting
was like,
in that palm tree, sharpening his blade.
He was ready to go, and the jury would have voted for him.
Yeah.
And you would have had a person who got voted out twice in the season who then comes back and wins the show and was out of the game for the majority of the season. And so I think that the danger of like for instance Rick, who went out and then came back in, what did he miss? 6 days? He didn't miss that much.
Right.
And then he had to play through the whole merge, whereas then I think there's just like the danger, like Reem could come back into the game and win.
Right.
Like this is,
'cause nobody knows.
And at some point I think it gets into like, well, what's the point of the 37 minutes we spend with the people on the beach if the person who we got to see 3 minutes a week ends up coming back to be the winner of the show? So I think it's, it's dangerous.
How would you, because I've obsessed over this, how would you turn it on its head? Like if Jeff came to you and I and said, I'm out, I need a 40th season, what would you do? How would you turn it around? Is there anything? Because also every time I go down a rabbit hole of like, well, let's start with one giant tribe. And then you go, well, that unravels so much of the show that it sort of falls apart. What would you do?
I don't know if you need to like really turn it on its head. I think that there's like there's tweaks that you can make, and I think that one of the things that they could do that might be sort of like a simple fix, but I understand that the reasons why it exists. But I really feel like that the amount of time that we spend on the reward challenge every week, where these episodes where it's like the whole second act of the show, and I understand that maybe for again, I don't know if it's an economics, where is it cheaper? It might be more expensive to do these challenges. And I understand that people like having the challenges, and I watch it with my kids, and the kids are really into the challenges. But if we spent that act on really like getting to know these characters better, as opposed to who cares, who gets to eat Chinese food.
But doesn't so much of the social game change on those reward challenges when people are having peanut butter and jelly together and going, hey, this is, we're going to, they always say the same thing.
Yeah.
We're the final five, no matter who it is.
Right. So, yeah, that does, look, it happens, but maybe we don't need one every week. You know, I think that, you know, that's a lot of time over the course of the season. You know, if we have like, we get rid of 7 or 8 reward challenges over the course of the season, and now that's like, you know, an extra, you know, 40 minutes of screen time that we can put into things like getting to know the characters better. I think that would be, a positive for the show.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with it. I'm obsessed with trying to figure out.
Have you gotten the invitation to go on location?
Yes, and I have always been shooting when he's been shooting.
Now, we saw in David versus Goliath another person who was a friend of Jeff and Mike White go play in David versus Goliath. Would you ever consider throwing on a buff?
No, here's the problem. And I've had this conversation with Jeff many times. I would get voted out first because I'm the worst at that my true colors would come out. Mm-hmm. I would be like, what the hell? I don't know that I could ever get used to the cameras being around, just knowing what I know and be right behind the scenes. And the first tribal, I'd be like, anyway, Jeff, I think I'm good. I just couldn't do it. And also, I just don't know that I have the drive to do it. I love watching it. And yeah. I don't play poker. I'm not good at board games. I don't have the mind to be that strategic. So I would be the idiot that'd be carried along and would blow himself up. And I just don't need the whole world to see all of my insanity on TV.
Do you know Mike White?
I do.
Okay. Yeah. Were you impressed with his game?
And by the way, that's who he is. I mean, he's incredibly thoughtful, incredibly intelligent. He loves games. He loves Jeff had a game night like 10 years ago. And
yeah.
I almost threw Neil Patrick Harris off the balcony. I'm just not good at it.
Yeah.
I don't have the personality for it. Yeah. So it's like I'm just not great at it. Whereas Michael White, I mean, he's hit the way his mind works. I loved him on Amazing Race with his dad, and I just think he loves it, and he even admits he loves it. He loves doing it, and so it's just not how I'm built.
Yeah, do you think that he would play again,
Mike?
Yeah,
totally.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he's a writer and he's very successful, and I haven't spoken to him about it specifically, but if you ever do, my guess is he's using all of this in his writing. I think he's learning about himself through these challenges and these events that he is that his writing's probably getting better for it.
Todd, so nice to get to talk to you.
Man. This is fun
about everything.
I was super intimidated about this because you are just you're a phenom in terms of your knowledge of all of this strategy and players and how it all goes down. So thank you for being gentle with me.
It's so much fun to get to talk about. And really, I can't believe it, you know, how animated and excited are about talking about this.
Thanks.
Okay, if people want to check out The Producer's Guide,
it's on Podcast One. Podcast One, The Producer's
Apple
Guide.
Podcasts.
Anywhere there's podcasts. And also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Todd_Garner.
Okay. All right, Todd. Thank you so much. And be sure to check out The Producer's Guide on Podcast One.
Thank you.